Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Hey Brahman, the conception of the Supreme without qualities is metaphorically thought of as his effulgence. We're going to look now at paragraph 9. Tata Sri Bhagavataha Sankhyakatane Kalo Maya Maye Jive Itya Adao Mahapralaye Sarv Abhashishna Tvena Brahmopadishya Tadapi Tasya Drashtvitva Swasmin Uktam. Thus, in his description of Sankhya philosophy, the personality of Godhead indicates, in the word's beginning, time merges into the Supreme Living Being. Time merges into the Supreme Living Being who includes the material nature within himself. Okay, that's Krishna talking, the Supreme Personality of Krishna speaking Sankhya philosophy to Uddhava. Now, when he says that, the time merges into the Supreme Living Being who includes the material nature within himself, he indicates that Brahman is what remains after everything is dissolved in the final annihilation of the universe. Why don't you open that door so we can get some air? And as a statement, in the Bhagavatam, same chapter, spoken by Krishna to Uddhava about Sankhya, Krishna says, Esha Sankhya Vidhi Proktam Samshaya Granti Bedanaha Pratiloma Nuloma Pyam Paravaradvisha Maya. That statement is, thus I, the perfect seer of everything, material and spiritual, have spoken this knowledge of Sankhya, which destroys the illusion of doubt by scientific analysis of creation and annihilation. Ityatra paravara prashit anena soyam chatra vivekama. There are the words, the seer of the spiritual and material, Paravada Drisha. I, who am Paravada Drish, have told you about Sankhya philosophy. Paravada Drish. The following is distinguished in that phrase. Sankhyam hi gyanam, tat shastra, kalo surubhuta tad vishesham anandu sandaya, yat tat surubhamatram, Tadanim avishishtam varati. Sankhya is a method of cultivating knowledge. And indeed, that teaching fails, I think we've read this already. Okay. Fails to consider the innate variety of the Supreme. That's Sankhya, not taught by Krishna, but Sankhya taught by ordinary people, fails to consider the innate variety of the Supreme. It instead talks only about his mere existence, which remains at the time of annihilation. Tadeva cha brahmakyam, tadeva cha prapancha avachinna charama pradeshe, prapancha layad, vaikunta iva, swarupa bhuta vishesha prakashad, avishesha manatvena, vaktum yujiyate. That is called Brahman, the mere existence of the Supreme. That's what we mean by personal godliness. That is called Brahman, and it is appropriate to describe it as the final identifiable portion of the material creation. What are we talking about? Well, you analyze the creation, and the final element is Brahman. What remains, that's the philosophers who are not devotees, that's as far as they can go. They can't analyze any further. What remains after the annihilation of the creation? What's left, Brahman? Because, unlike Vaikuntha, it does not reveal the particulars of the Supreme's essence. Brahman doesn't do that. Vaikuntha does reveal the particulars of the Supreme's essence. Tacha swavishesha matram swarupa shakti visheshena vaikunthasthena sri bhagavata pritam iva tatranu bhuyata iti. In the annihilation, Brahman is perceived as if separate from the personality of Godhead. Well, okay, this is non-devotees seeing the end of the universe in their philosophical eye and seeing absolute truth left and nothing else. They think that's something different from the personality of Godhead. The personality of Godhead is some fiction in the Vaikuntha, some fantasy of the minds of the devotees. But they're looking at the absolute truth. They don't realize that absolute truth and Narayan are the same thing. But the materialists can't recognize that. So in the annihilation, Brahman is perceived by the philosophers as if separate from the personality of Godhead, who remains situated in Vaikuntha along with the variety of his internal potency. Well, that's why it seems separate. Because here's Brahman all by himself after the annihilation. And there's, Narayan living it up in Vaikuntha with his friends and family. It doesn't seem to be the same. Tadevam nirvisheshatvena sparsha rupa rahitasyapi tasya bhagavat prabha rupatvam utpreksha tarabhinatvena brahmatvam vipatishtam. Thus, even though Brahman has no particular qualities, and so is devoid of perceivable touch and form, it is metaphorically conceived of as the bodily effulgence of the personality of Godhead, and it is designated Brahma, the Supreme, because it is none different from him. It really is none different. And understanding that Brahman is the bodily effulgence of the Lord helps us understand that he's not different. How is he not different? Well, it's like a person's effulgence, or his hair, or his fingernails. It's not different from him, even though they're not alive. But actually, Brahman is alive. We just don't see the life in Brahman. Okay. Now the commentary. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, taught his own version of Sankhya philosophy to Uddhava. Well, we read this commentary already. Let's just go ahead. You want to hear it again? Okay. On a popular demand. In that instruction, Krishna referred to Brahman by the term Jiva. This is a rare usage of the word,
But it is not possible, that jiva in this context could mean the finite souls, who are numerous, not one, and who at the time being described, that's the annihilation, they were asleep and unmanifest. So it's not the jiva seeing everything, because the jiva's asleep. All the jivas are asleep at that time.
There is one verse in Vishnu Sahasranam, which the name for Lord is jiva is mentioned.
Yes. Yeah, elsewhere you'll see that, you know, jiva is also one of his names. Lord Krishna's version of Sankhya is an authoritative philosophy, not just another speculative probing for truth. It was originally conceived and explained by God himself. The personal jnana pays no attention to the vishesha, the variety of in the Supreme. The cultivation of jnana in the Sankhya system is taught by Bhagavan Krishna and Bhagavan Kapila. Unlike the version of Sankhya, popular among atheists, gives ample attention to this vishesha, which distinguishes the concept of Bhagavan from that of Brahman. This variety of the Supreme Lord is generally not revealed in the material realm, except for during his occasional avatars. At other times, pure devotees can see Bhagavan's vishesha. But non-devotees cannot. Impersonalist transcendentalists only see Brahman as the remnant of creation. But impersonalists cannot. What did I just say? Impersonal transcendentalists only see Brahman as the remnant of creation after its annihilation. They only know that Brahman is Jagmadyasyantaha, the source from which derive the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the world of duality. But impersonalists cannot use the things of this world in Brahman's service. Before they can obtain their Brahman realization, they need to experience annihilation. So they have to be destroyed first before they can become Brahman realized. Experience annihilation, at least of their own personal life. They disregard Bhagavan, thinking him to be less than Brahman. In truth, however, he, Bhagavan, is the real Brahman. The personal Brahman only borrows that name from him. Okay, any questions?
What is the need to say, at least before they attain the Brahman realization, they need to experience annihilation, at least in their own personal life?
Well, yes. Well, the whole universe doesn't have to be destroyed, but they can't realize Brahman until you give up all concepts of duality. You have to become liberated before you can realize Brahman. And as far as the person is concerned, you have to stop being a person. You have to stop being a person to give up all duality. So basically, you have to annihilate your own self. Fortunately, you don't have to annihilate the whole universe. That's not required. But you have to annihilate your individual existence. Although, until you do that, you're not actually Brahman realized.
Devotees
don't have to kill themselves or anybody else to become Krishna conscious. Yes.
I have a question about when time of the creation comes, so we have this particular universe, then Supreme Lord, they enter into the body of Mahavishnu. So, and then only Brahman remains. So
what happened to some people? Some people, Lord entered, what?
So, when
did that happen? Did that happen? Supreme Lord enters?
All the universes enter.
Oh, all the universes, okay. Yes.
So, and the public is then this building, or the Brahman is the main city.
Well, see, the Mayavadis don't consider Mahavishnu to be the ultimate source of creation. They trace it all the way back to Brahma. They have an idea even Mahavishnu originated back to Brahma. Mahavishnu is an expansion, he's an illusion. He's a creation of avidya imposed on the totality of Brahma, the world of goodness. So that has to be wound up also. Mahavishnu has to go back into Brahma too. Then you go trace it all the way back, or it's all about complete annihilation, leaves you with nothing but Brahma, from the Mayavadi point of view. Otherwise, it's not complete annihilation, you still have Mahavishnu lying around. That's just between creations, but what about winding up the whole show? And he has to go back into Brahma too. Then you got total annihilation.
How do they explain how the creation starts?
It's hard to explain. They introduced the idea of avidya. Avidya does the dirty work. But how? There's arguments against that conception that if avidya is something real, a real power, a real entity, then you have two entities. You have God and you have avidya. You've got a duality. Then you've got a good guy and a bad guy. I got God and his opponent. Both of them existing, real. And if it is not real, then how can it do anything? How can it have any effect on Brahman if it's not real? So it's hard to actually justify that conception of avidya as something that can actually do anything. And avidya is supposed to be the cause of duality. But you can't say whether it exists or it doesn't work, if it exists or it doesn't exist. So you just have to write, say, well, it's inconceivable. You can't say it exists or it doesn't exist. But that's just evading the issue. Yes?
You mentioned in the translation from bottom to up, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
It is appropriate to describe it as a final identifying portion of the material creation.
I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong place. Appropriate is the word?
So it is called Brahman and it is appropriate to describe. Maybe 8, 9 from below.
I got it. That is called Brahman and it is appropriate to describe something. Yes?
So it is just appropriate to describe, but as he sorry, it was.
The annihilation goes into the body of Mahavishnu. If we, where is the two conceptions? It goes into Brahman or it goes into Mahavishnu's body?
Well,
the proper understanding that we get, the Vaishnavas read from the Puranas, is that Mahavishnu doesn't merge into Brahman. Mahavishnu, remains as he is eternally. He may get up from his bed and go back to Vaikuntha, but he's not wound up like the material elements. So that's the Mayavadi idea. We certainly don't agree with it.
So is this Mayavadi's quotation spoken in translation?
No. Oh.
Maybe
I see. How do we agree that it's appropriate to say that only Brahman realized remains at the annihilation. Okay, good question. Don't have an immediate answer. I'm writing down the question because I don't think we can answer it. How is it appropriate that Prabhupada alone It's appropriate for us if we understand that Brahman is Vishnu. Only Vishnu remains, and Vishnu is Brahman, so that in that sense it's fine with us.
Yeah.
But if we consider Brahman to be something different from Vishnu, we can't agree with the Mayavadi viewpoint. But we can agree that on the basis of the assumption that Brahman and Bhagawan are the same, one entity, Bhagawan only remains after the annihilation. Krishna says that in the Chaturvishloki Bhagavatam, Yo Vishesheshya So Smyaham, only I remain. So that's fine with us, because in our mathematics, Brahman equals Bhagawan. Brahman is the only thing remaining because Bhagawan's the only thing remaining, and Bhagawan can also be called Brahman. For us, the two names are interchangeable.
But here the argument is, he is a seer of the remnants. So here, that's the main argument, is to separate Bhagawan from them.
He is the seer. I'm sorry.
The argument
is that he is the seer. Well, that's Krishna saying, I am the seer.
Yeah, so that means we are differentiating. That is the main point of the whole
initiative. No. Krishna is not saying, I'm different from Brahman, is he?
Like, that's what it is established, that Bhagavan is Anandamaya, Brahman is superior to Brahman.
Well, yeah, but not different. What is inferior about Brahman is that it's Krishna, but not being seen completely. It's the vision that's different. Yes, yes. That means that yes, we agree, because the Shastra tells us Brahman alone remains after the annihilation. But our understanding of that is that Brahman is the conscious, live personality of Godhead. He remains after the annihilation. So when everything else is wound up, he's the seer of everything, you know, during creation and after creation. But it's Bhagavan, it's not some separate Brahman from our viewpoint. But then we got to look at the way the Mayavadis see it. They see a difference between Brahman and Bhagavan.
He is a witness of that Brahman. There is a specific word.
Where does it say that?
From the translation from Amo, maybe 7, 8.
Okay. That Brahman. Brahman, he's a witness of that particular aspect of himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's a witness of his own avatars, and Mahavishnu is one of his avatars. Or if this merging is back into an impersonal Brahman, but we don't hear it like that in the Upanishad Brahmanas, we hear that it goes back to Mahavishnu. And not further to something personally. Mahavishnu disappears and it just dissolves into impersonality. We don't read about that in the Puranas. But even if that was your concept, you make up a story like that. Still, that's Krishna looking at himself in the form of Brahman, in his impersonal disguise. It's Krishna himself pretending to be impersonal. Krishna is looking at himself. I'm the witness of everything, even when I pretend to be impersonal, you know, I take the form of energy, creative energy, and I seem to be the power that creates the universe, impersonal power. It's me in disguise. Krishna's saying, I'm watching myself do that. That's the way it is. There's prakasha, which means perception or revelation. And then there's Swayam Prakasha, something that doesn't have to borrow light from something else but generates its own light. That, like the sun. But a living entity is more than the sun. The sun is Swayam Prakasha, but a living being is Swasmai Swayam Prakasha. He's self-luminous to himself. He sees a living entity, sees himself. The sun generates light. The moon has to have light shine it, but the sun generates its own light. But the living entity not only generates his own consciousness, or has his own consciousness, but he sees himself. Swasmai Swayam Prakasha. So the Supreme Lord especially, he knows everything, including himself.
Can you say that he is a witness of the Brahman?
I would take it either of two ways.
Yeah.
Either some impersonal feature, but I don't see a description in the Shastra of the creation merging back into something impersonal. The alternative is that he's seeing himself in the form of Mahavishnu.
But we are putting the impersonalists as seeing the Brahman as Brahman.
That's how they're personalists. You're asking, you know, two different things. How we see it and how the Mayavadis see it.
Yeah,
Mayavadis have got a whole version that everything, including Bhagavan, merges back into a personal Brahman. That's their version. But I don't see that version fitting the description of the Puranas.
I also heard some explanation that the creation starts with the spiritual world,
there's different creation is a complex process. You could say, where does your automobile begin from? Well, it begins in the factory in Detroit. But you could say, no, it begins in the coal, in the iron fields, in Wisconsin, where they dig up the iron. Or no, it begins, in the sun that generated the heat, the light and heat that turned into the iron, whatever. They made the hydrogen molecules in outer space turn into bigger molecules, and that's where the iron came from. So there are complex causes for everything. So also, creation of the universe has many causes. Glance of Vishnu on Prakriti is the immediate cause. But where did the substance come from? It's residing in Prakriti, but you can trace it back further to the spiritual substance of Vaikuntha. The material energy is an expansion of the Vishuddha substance of Vaikuntha. So there's different ways you can view the cause of the creation. You can trace it back in different directions as far as you want. Because it's complex. The causes are complex. It's not like Mahavishnu looked and everything just popped out of his eye. Nothing existed before, and it just burst out of his eye when he glanced at Prakriti. No, the ingredients were already there in Prakriti. So it's more complex than just all created just by the glance. It's the Supreme Lord acting, but he's acting through multifold energies, many different energies, even to create the material world.
I was thinking the whole point of this anicheta is the mind of this arrest at once before they are seeing the Brahman as the last remnants of material.
And they're seeing a difference between Brahman and Bhagavan. And they're thinking that Bhagavan's inferior.
Yeah, so we are saying that if Bhagavan is inferior, then Bhagavan won't be witnessing
Right. That's an argument against the idea of Bhagavan being inferior to Brahman.
Yeah,
because
so
even when everything else is gone, Bhagavan is watching Brahman.
Yeah, so that means we have accepted that the creation ends in the Brahman, bags in the Brahman, and Bhagavan is. Like, we are this, only for that.
It's more like I think we're accepting it hypothetically. Okay, this is your version.
Okay.
Let's, granting it hypothetically, still you got Bhagavan saying that he was the witness of that annihilation.
But we are not putting those statements in a quotation or something. We are not putting those statements in a quotation. It is like part of the, there's not clearly known that anybody reached this translation of the book. We are not even saying that
yeah.
If you think like this, nothing is mentioned like that. There's
OK.
Okay.
That's what anybody can understand.
Could you? I want to make a note of that, but could you say that again?
For example, that is called Brahman.
Yeah.
Starting from the statement, Sankhya is a method of cultivating knowledge.
Yeah.
And indeed, that teaching fails to consider the innate variety of the Supreme. It instead only talks about His mere existence.
Yes.
Which remains at that time of annihilation.
Yes.
That is called Brahman. And it is inappropriate to describe it as the final identified portion of material creation.
Yes.
It is appropriate to describe it. Sorry, same statement. It is the final identified portion of the material creation. So we are like, it is appropriate to describe it as the final identified portion of the material creation, what remains after the annihilation of the creation. So this statement, we are putting in a quotation, this is what they are saying or anything like that.
Right.
So
the question is, who says it's appropriate?
Except it's true that even if you consider this statement, I don't know if Jiva Goswami speaks like that, but what is understanding?
One second. You're reading from the translation, not the commentary, right?
The translation.
Yeah. Okay, let me check this. I'm sorry we're taking time, not moving on, but this is important. Oh, I have to find the exact place. You did say okay. Well, Vaktu Avashishimana Twena Vaktu Yujyate. That's called Brahman, and it's appropriate, it's the words he uses. So I can't change what he says, but I can try to clarify it in the commentary, since it's creating confusion. All I can do right now is make a note of it. I'll deal with this, I understand now what the problem is. And I'll have to try to find a solution. I can't do that right now. So let me just, I'm just doing one last thing, putting something in italics. And then we move on. Okay, but yes, you're right, there's a problem here for the reader. It's hard to understand who's talking about it being appropriate and why. But I'll say something in the commentary that explains it. Now we try the next paragraph, unless you have something. Yes, sir.
Remember in one of the previous chapters, we have this description that actually Bhagavan is Bhagavan, but when we don't have a Bhagavan, we see him as Bhagavan. We see him only as a person Bhagavan.
Yes.
Maybe this is the case that Krishna, he remains, he's not only Bhagavan, he remains Bhagavan, but because he is.
Yes.
This way,
yes. I mean, that's the way I understand it. That for us, he's Bhagavan, for them, he's impersonal. He's never impersonal for us anyway. Especially after the end of creation, Mahavishnu doesn't dissolve. He's still there. He may get up from his sleep, but actually he stays there and just, keeps on breathing, and the next creation comes out, actually. Maybe there's an end of all of it, and when he finally gets up. Anyway, someone reading this, and you sense a confusion here, although we understand that, it's not clearly brought out in the commentary.
Maybe
it's like Bhagavan is the same Mahavishnu, and he remains behind, but they cannot see him. They think that it's just Brahma Vishnu remains. But this is only they don't have to see. So actually, Mahavishnu remains after annihilation.
And
the personalists think that he's impersonal.
And in this way, they can also distinguish. then he looks at his own.
That's the distinction. And also, what was mentioned here, the impersonalists, they see something different. That this final thing left after annihilation, that's impersonal Brahman. You're Narayan, he's over there at Vaikuntha, he's something else. That's the impersonalist viewpoint. Narayan's in a different place. This is inside the universe, this is Brahman. That's how the impersonalists take it. But we see Mahavishnu is Narayan, and Mahavishnu doesn't dissolve. Oh, yeah, okay.
I just want to clarify what I understand. Like sometimes, so actually the whole universe is merging back into the body of Mahavishnu.
Right.
And because and the universe is no more there, the Mayavadis don't know Mahavishnu as a person, he's beyond Brahman.
They know of him, but they think that he's not the final end.
Yeah, so then they think that everything is gone into Brahman, including Mahavishnu.
Yes.
So in order to refute his argument, we are saying that if that is the case, here Krishna is saying that I am seeing that Brahman.
Right. See, but the thing is, the point of this paragraph is not to settle the argument. Let them think that.
Mm-hmm.
Let them think that the ultimate, you know, what's left is impersonal. But Krishna says, I'm the witness of that impersonal that's left over after Brahman. So, you know, Krishna is still superior to it. If that's Brahman, then Krishna is superior to it. Because he's watching it. But we don't have to argue here which view is correct. You can even take the wrong view. And even in the wrong view, Krishna is superior to Brahman.
Maybe that, I think
that
doesn't mean the wrong view.
Yeah, even in the wrong view, that only Brahman view, the impersonal Brahman, remains. Krishna said that he's witnessing it. I'm just making a quick note that I can reword later. Yes?
I think that point also, it is metaphorically considered that we exist today, or what exactly that is also.
Well, it's like what's left after annihilation is metaphorically called Brahman, but actually it's Bhagavan. Mm-hmm. It's not impersonal. What's left after annihilation is not impersonal. It's Mahavishnu lying there on his bed of the snake bed. That's not impersonal.
No, we are saying that it is metaphorically conceived.
Oh, that's I'm saying similar to that. This is also a metaphor to call what remains after annihilation Brahman is also metaphorical. It's really Bhagavan.
Okay, so it's not just bodily effulgence of the Lord, but it is Bhagavan himself.
Yeah, just like the bodily effulgence is not impersonal. It's shine of his personal body, and he and his body are not different. So by being the shine of his body doesn't make it impersonal.
So why do they make this bodily effulgence? What is the reason for that?
Because the Upanishads tell us.
So why for whom they are telling this? For what reason?
The bodily effulgence is Krishna. It's Krishna, you know, Krishna and his body are the same. It is bodily, but it isn't impersonal. It is the absolute truth. Everything about Krishna is the absolute truth. His name is the absolute truth.
Yeah.
The shine of his body is the absolute truth. But that absolute truth, the shine of his body, is not impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
You want to find impersonal Brahman, you look in the wrong place, because this shine is not impersonal. That's the metaphor, that's the inexactness. That they think it's impersonal. It is the absolute truth. The shine, the effulgence of Krishna's body. But it's not impersonal.
In our translation, every time we say person and Brahman,
right. So like we're going along with the metaphor. We're going along with the metaphor when we do that.
The metaphor is
a long metaphor. The whole concept of impersonal Brahman is ultimately metaphorical because there's nothing impersonal about Krishna. He's just pretending to be impersonal. It's like a child putting a sheet over his head and pretending to be a ghost. There's no ghost there.
It's a kid with a sheet over his head. So it's Krishna disguised as a person.
Why this impersonal name is given every place in Prabhupada?
Because, okay, Krishna appears as his devotees, as those who meditate on him, want him to appear. And there's lots of people in the world that want Krishna to be impersonal. So, there's a great demand for Krishna to be impersonal. So Krishna says, okay, I'll be impersonal, you call me Prabhu. Well, okay, Vedanti Tat Tattva Vidas Tattva Vyajnanam. There are various sages, and they conceive of the Absolute Truth in different ways. So there's a party of people who want Krishna to be impersonal. And the Upanishads are largely written to appeal to that audience. The devotees would rather read Bhagavatam. They have respect for the Upanishads, and they quote them to back up their philosophy. But they're more interested in reading about Krishna and his pastimes. But there is a large class of people in the world who want to hear about the impersonal aspect. They don't want the Supreme, they just don't want the Supreme to be a person. So to humor them, the Supreme Person pretends to be impersonal.
So that is not
mentioned in the commentary. Well, because that's... No, I mean, I could get into that, but that's, yeah.
But somebody can take it as a kind of, Prabhupada says everybody is the same person, but it is only a metaphor.
Well, then we have to go back, not in this paragraph, but go way back when we start talking about impersonal.
Yeah.
Clarify, it's really Krishna in disguise.
Yeah, because there is something new concept. It is, I don't know
anything. Well, yeah, well, because it's new and Prabhupada new, talk much in that way. I don't want to be too innovative. You know, start explaining things different than Prabhupada did. But we should have earlier explained that Brahma is Krishna in disguise. How's that? Something like that. I may have said that actually, but to make it clearer. Sometimes I say something, not, you know, I say, but I don't say it out front enough, I just say indicated, but I don't say it obviously enough. So, okay. Yeah, we should have explained more obviously that Krishna, that Brahman is Krishna in disguise. And I'll go back and find a good place to say it, but I think this is too late. If they'll be totally confused by now if they didn't understand that in the beginning. So as soon as we start this discussion, maybe at the beginning of the energy.
I think it comes after, before 4 or 5 verses.
You think in 90, okay, you think maybe 92.4 or 5?
Yeah.
Okay. These are good notes, but rather than work it all out now, I'll just leave this for to check later. Yes.
In teaching so much, there is a separate section on the order word Mayavadan. Like there's something maybe something can be. In teaching so much,
yes.
There's a separate section, article.
Yes.
Word about Mayavadan, partially about Mayavadan. Something can be included like maybe something like that.
Where is there
a separate section? Chaitanya?
I don't know.
In many books, Prabhupada books, they print up one page of a caution about Mayava or something.
Where does that come from?
I don't know, some small two paragraph. He say something.
That was written by Prabhupada or no?
Not by Prabhupada. It's
put into Prabhupada's book?
Yeah, it's
just
there.
But nowadays, previously used to put it.
No, it is there in teaching Prabhupada.
They used to put it in every book before, but now.
I don't know about, I mean, this is a whole big controversy nowadays about adding footnotes to Prabhupada's books that weren't there before.
No,
the devotees are up in arms about this.
One page,
a whole page inserted into Prabhupada's book that Prabhupada didn't write.
It is even before the topic begins, like Path of Perfection. And second page, a caution about Mayavada, then the book starts, Path of Perfection.
I see, it's before the book, it's like an introduction by the publisher. I see. Okay. Well, okay, but do we need that for the Bhagavad Sadharma? If someone is going to read this book, he better know our basic philosophy, otherwise he's not going to be able to follow it. Yeah. And there's a lot about showing the fallacy in Mayavad, in the Sarasambhavati, which we haven't been reading. It goes on for 60 pages. But not the basic fallacies, the detailed, step by step, all the things that are wrong with Mayavad. Okay, but I do have to, I mean, if our intelligent devotees are confused about this, then others are going to be totally confused. So I'll try to fix it. I'll do the necessary to make this clearer. You mean two paragraphs back?
Yeah, but I'm well, thinking that if we don't understand these things, we will not be able to understand future.
Okay, can you show me exactly where that is? What that is?
We left out whole translation, we'll discuss later.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
We left one Anucheda.
It's a paragraph. I call it a paragraph. I'm sorry, which one?
About the tail.
Yeah.
92.6.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I have a note here that this sentence, compared to which tale, unclear as worded. So I have a note that it's a mess and has to be fixed. I don't know how to fix it, but for this I'll have to go, for this sentence that you're questioning, I have to go back and read the Sanskrit, make sure I got it right, and then try to figure out how I can make it clearer. First thing for me to make sure I didn't say something just wrong. Then I have to see if I can say it in such a way that readers have an easier time understanding it. So that's going to take some work. This is the kind of thing I have to sit down and work on it for a day or two or three. But I have it noted here that it has to be fixed. But right now I'm not even clear what the problem actually is here. So just that it's not very clear. So rather than go back and deal with that now, that's for later, for me to work on later. Now, we have to stop instead of writing. Yes, go ahead.
I can ask like, some general questions.
Yes, yes.
I'm just wondering that if you also retell this detail of this understanding, but the Kali Yuga is progressing now, and like who are the recipients of this teachings, like, you know?
Serious students of Srimad Bhagavatam.
If that is the case, so many things are remaining, like practical preaching or serious devotees who are
watching. This is not a bridge book. The bridge books that bridge the gap between material consciousness and material culture, introducing people to Krishna consciousness from the very scratch.
Yeah.
This is not such a book. This is for intellectual, serious devotees. Tapasadharma had a more general audience.
Yeah.
It addressed basic questions, and basically justified the authority of the Bhagavad Gita. Now we're getting into the heavy, heavy philosophy. And this is for those who are serious about actually understanding what Srimad Bhagavatam has to say.
I mean, like,
say,
for instance, they have this discuss and understand amongst each other, because so many other things are also pending.
We're sitting here. The rest of ISKCON is going on with their practical work. We're the ones sitting here just talking. Because the practical workers and all the devotees and the people they're preaching to, they've got questions.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to come up with the answers. So we have to understand this tough stuff
so that we can give them simple answers. We have to understand the nitty-gritty, you know, all these complex, subtle philosophical details, so that when a devotee asks a question, we can give a straightforward, simple answer. We need, you know, whoever can study this in Dharma, actually go through it thoroughly. Then you become equipped to resolve doubts. Not by dumping the same details on someone, but by distilling it and giving the essence.
So
applying it.
That means you have to catch it nicely and clearly and properly.
Yeah. I mean, this is not an easy job, just to read this book. I can't make it easy without diluting it. I can wash it down and, you know, shave the corners and make it smooth, but then it'll dilute it.
So that means it requires kind of study for a long time with like kind of this current situation for 4 or 5 years, then you'll be able to get some understanding between each other's like that.
Yeah. And that may be too much trouble for many devotees to try to do that.
Yeah, but like we are all here for 2 years, then
yes.
Like the course, the school here, like we are here for some time, and something else already covered before. And I mean, I was not here for my own case. I was not here for the beginning of Bhagavad Sandharva or Sandharva.
Yes.
Or I don't know how long I'll be there.
Yes.
3 years old.
Yes.
So what is the kind of benefit of students, or what is your point of view, how you are teaching these courses?
Well, we're still not experimenting. We're not experimenting. We're trying out, you know, getting started. The next phase is to have a more systematic, somewhat pre-digested version. And our teaching staff is supposed to be working on that. And then everybody who joins our school gets it from the beginning, as far, you know, gets the whole course. It's presented systematically. I'm not in a position where I can sit down and do that. So someone's going to have to sit down and spend a couple of months developing that course. I can't stop and do that. I have to continue translating. So all I can do is what I'm doing, which is an incomplete job. You know, it doesn't do the whole job. It's just the first attempt.
For that person has to experience and learn.
Yeah, we'd have to actually study it really carefully and like sit down and work out all the knotty things and figure them out.
I don't know anybody that's in there other than you. It's like, I mean,
I've seen
this from
the beginning to the other place. Yeah. But I'm not for making a neat systematic class, I'm not the best person for that. You know, so there's others who think more systematically and organized. Yeah, so I think we're good.
It's about the question of importance of this book of world, Siddhanta, and take it closer in general. I remember you went to Prado around 10 years ago, one day made a famous sannyasi.
And Siddhartha's where you're going to get those arguments.
Yes, it's very, very important to have this knowledge, because otherwise, nobody can get this arguments. And especially my wife, they might be very, very strong with this vision.
So, that seems to have been, I can't guess what's in the heart of Jiva Goswami, but he's, you know, an intimate devotee of Radha Krishna, who's getting involved in all this, you know, dry philosophy to protect the faith of the devotees, to strengthen their faith and protect it against attacks. That's the whole purpose. You may be confident, but you can help other devotees who are not so strong in their faith.
So especially when we can see his mythology, he takes one point and then he gives one argument, then another argument, and he wins his 30 arguments with just two or one point.
But in order to save someone's faith, not just for the sake of arguing, not for the enjoyment of arguing. Prabhupada would also, get into argument and philosophy, but for spiritual purposes. No, it's just that we're over time and that's going to mess up the schedule. Why don't we just continue tomorrow?
Yeah.
Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.
Tell bro, it's only meant for you. If you just turn like this in the class, you'll see your baby sleeping behind. Yeah, like the blue bottom. There are actually bottom, in the blue bottom. Like, so kind of is up.
Thank you.
Yeah.